Welcome to the CSIS podcast. I'm Colin Quinn, and this week we're back to the Middle East, where seven governments, including Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates, have cut ties and closed borders with their neighbour Qatar over alleged support of regional terrorist groups. To complicate things further, Qatar is home to the US military's Central Command, and its Al Udeid Air Base is home to 10,000 US personnel. So if the US is trying to keep all its allies happy in this dispute, it'll have a fine line to walk. To talk us through what's going on and why this happened is Anthony Cordesman, the Burke Chair in Strategy at CSIS.
I think the official explanations are the right ones. Qatar has taken a different stand on the Muslim Brotherhood. It is seen as allowing or supporting the financing of Islamist extremist movements, which the other countries see as threats, like the Muslim Brotherhood. It is seen as not supporting the rest of the Arab Gulf states in confronting Iran. It is seen as not supporting the UAE and Saudi effort in the war in Yemen. And it is seen by other states, like Egypt, as soft on the Muslim Brotherhood, tolerant of extremist groups like Hamas. There also is simply the problem of imagery. Ever since the British left the Gulf back in the 1960s, there has been repeated tension between Qatar and the UAE and Saudi Arabia over border issues, over succession issues, over virtually every aspect of media coverage, censorship, and the political evolution of the region.
And what makes Qatar unique here?
Well, don't forget that tensions between Arab Gulf states are as much the rule as the exception. There are tensions that are longstanding problems between Oman and Saudi Arabia. There have been border issues which have affected the various states. There are different perceptions of how to deal with Iraq. And in the past, and perhaps even today, each of the Gulf states pursued a different strategy in supporting the Sunni Arab rebel movements inside Syria. These are, like their European counterparts and Asian counterparts, independent states, and feuding between independent states, as the British withdrawal from the common market shows, is the global rule, not the exception.
But how does this affect the base then that the U.S. has about 10,000 troops there? So does the U.S. then pull out because it agrees, or does it stay in and say, oh, we're okay with this country that allegedly supports groups that we don't agree with?
When we look at the U.S. position on Qatar, I think we need to begin with a strategic position, not simply the base. Having a unified Arab Gulf position, having interoperable, integrated Gulf forces that can work with U.S., British, and French forces is a key strategic objective. The base is only part of that objective. It is important because you can't have effective theater ballistic missile defense, for example. You can't integrate the air-sea battle without having integrated sensors and forces. Above all, you can't create a solid deterrent front, and the issue here is to avoid war fighting, not simply to win what could be a catastrophic conflict. So whenever you have this level of tension, it threatens that strategic unity, which is critical to the U.S. because it potentially increases the risk of war. The problem also goes further. If this got to the extreme where Qatar, for example, should invite Iran to act as a counterbalance to its former Arab allies, that potentially would place Iranian influence on the southern side of the Gulf. And that would be a critical strategic shift. Now, the air base is much more than simply an air base. It is critical to the integration of intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance throughout the region. It is the main operating center for any kind of integrated air operation between the United States, its allies, and the Gulf Air Forces, the Arab Gulf Air Forces. So it's certainly very important because of all the bases it can sustain extensive operations and do so without any constraints. And Qatar is the only country that allows the U.S. to freely move all types of aircraft in and out of the base. It would be extraordinarily difficult to replace, and not simply because of the air battle, but because of intelligence, the air-sea battle, and above all, of course, the deterrent value. It would take time to come to anything close to that base. It isn't a matter of simply moving the people or the aircraft. You have large stocks of supplies. You have highly specialized ground facilities. You are set up to use unmanned combat aerial vehicles and key intelligence platforms. All of these make this a very difficult thing to suddenly substitute for and raise really serious questions of what would happen to that base if the U.S. left.
And so what do you make then of President Trump almost trying to take credit for the fact that these countries have now turned against Qatar, saying, you know, this is something he was hearing on the trip and now it's happened? Do you think he maybe hasn't thought through, perhaps, what the stakes are for the U.S. there?
I think that, like many of the recent events in the White House, this is, shall we say, a visceral reaction rather than an informed one. Secretary Mattis had chosen a different position and chosen it publicly before the president acted. Certainly Secretary Tillerson, I suspect the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and even the president's national security advisor would all have had the U.S. stand aside, try to mediate, try to work out a compromise. And I think that all of them, two cabinet officials, the chairman and the national security advisor, would have realized that Qatar is not the only country where there is financial support of terrorism, a great deal of which is private, not coming from government, a great deal of which is funneled through banks in Europe or in Asia, not coming directly from the country, and is extraordinarily difficult to police. I think that there would have been an understanding that pushing Qatar in the wrong ways could easily lead it to be more aggressive in supporting Islamist movements, which aren't necessarily terrorist, but are potentially extremist or hardline in character. And you need to remember that in an era where oil revenues today, for all of these countries, are about 50% or less of what they were in 2012, Qatar has immense surplus resources. If it chooses to act out of anger, it can do a great deal of harm to other countries in the region with relatively little amounts of money. These are all good reasons, quite aside from the need to have a solid and common front with all of the states in the region and the U.S., to not single out Qatar, to not confuse limited reductions in funding of extremist movements with any kind of major victory, and to avoid taking the position that the U.S. is somehow going to intervene in the internal affairs or squabbles of Gulf states.
And so the U.S. role here is almost to step back, to try and
I don't think that it is to step back, but it is to quietly mediate. It is to seek compromises. And a, shall we say, quieter and more focused approach might have persuaded Qatar to take effective action in the areas where it has created problems through supporting terrorism or extremism. At the same time, it might have been to talk to the other Gulf states about the need to be careful not to demonize Iran as a country. When you have a president that's more moderate than the supreme leader and a people who in general seem to have very little support for hardline positions, you want to be very careful about using the term Iran rather than referring to the Supreme Leader and the Islamic Revolutionary Guards. Strategy here and tactics would be best as a mediator, and best if the U.S. tried to influence rather than choose sides.
I'm wondering if there's any room for cooperation in the fact, in just by the fact that today in Iran was the first claimed ISIS attack in the country, and whether there is any room for cooperation there between the countries. If they all do say that they are anti-terrorist and they do want to root out these groups.
Let's be realistic, because even in Europe, you see that European powers find it extraordinarily difficult to coordinate their internal anti-terrorism movements, much less really share and work together in counterterrorism. These are problems within the Arab Gulf states, and they long have been. No one really wants to be totally transparent about intelligence or the terrorist threat or the opposition. A lot of the measures which probably could help deal with counterterrorism are not being taken, even among the Arab states, which are the closest in cooperating. And that, unfortunately, is true of the entire world. The rhetoric of cooperation is simply not the reality. And here we are talking about a regime still under a supreme leader, still sponsoring and supporting active opposition to many of the causes which really matter to the Arab states. Syria and the Arab rebels is an example. It is certainly challenging the United States and the Arab states for influence in Iraq. It is a problem in Bahrain, in Kuwait, and in Yemen. There are real differences between the Iranian regime and what is happening with the Arab Gulf states. There are real differences between Iran and the United States. And I think, too, that just as people tend to somehow ignore the long history of tension between Qatar and its Arab neighbors, they also tend to ignore some of the realities in dealing with these problems in terms of Iran's history. Iran may have had the first ISIS attack in Iran, but it has claimed to have had Arab terrorist movements in its southwest for decades. It has a very clear Baluchi threat in its southeast. Terrorism and violent opposition is not new to Iran. During the time Khomeini was in power, the People's Mujahideen, a Marxist, rather odd movement, and basically the Khomeini faction were virtually involved in a low-level civil war of terrorist attacks. So this is a pattern of violence where just because Iran has suffered, it is not going to suddenly change its behavior. And where, again, every time we hear people talk at a political level about cooperation on counterterrorism, you have to be extraordinarily demanding about the reality.
And those were the final words from Anthony Cordesman this week, and nearly the final ones from me. We'll of course be back with more next week. Until then, get in touch with me about the show on Twitter or by email cquinn@csis.org. As always, thanks for listening.